This week's Data Nuts podcast is sponsored in part by Interop ITX, the only independent conference for technology leaders. Get a year's worth of objective IT education in 1 week. Visit interopitx.com and use promo code PacketPushers for a 20% discount. The easiest way to secure and accelerate your website is with Encapsula, protecting over 4 million sites, from individual bloggers to the Fortune 50. Visit encapsula.com/packetpushers and use promo code DataNauts to get a 30-day free trial. Today on Data Nuts, we talk about your career. We have with us Neil Anderson, a trainer based in Southeast Asia, who surveyed CTOs and HR department heads about the skills and qualifications they are looking for the most in their IT department. I am Ethan Banks. Merry Christmas and happy holidays to all of you. You can follow me at EC Banks, and with me is my co-host Chris Wall, whose dubstep bluegrass mashup album is about to take the clubbing world by storm. He's at Chris Wall on Twitter. And this is the Data Nuts podcast. You can find this and all of our shows on iTunes, in your favorite podcatcher, or at packetpushers.net. Neil Anderson, welcome to the show. And if you would, please introduce yourself to our audience.
Hi, Ethan. Thanks very much for having me on. Yeah, I'm Neil Anderson. And I'm a trainer, like you said, based in Southeast Asia. I also train pretty much all over the world as well, though. I've been doing that for the last 9 years, and I'm specializing mostly in cloud and data center training now.
Do you go to clubs to listen to dubstep bluegrass mashups? Because apparently that's my future career.
I actually invented that.
Oh, crap. Good answer. All right, I'll throw it back to Ethan.
So, Neil, you're in Southeast Asia, right? But you don't sound like that at all. Where are you actually from?
I'm from Scotland originally, but my accent's a bit strange, I know. I've been traveling really since I was 17, so, and that's a long time ago now. So, yeah, my accent's changed quite a lot.
Scotland, now you live there. Okay. How did you get started in IT?
Okay, this is quite a long story. I definitely didn't do it the traditional way. I actually dropped out of school when I was 15, basically because back then I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I didn't have much motivation while I was at school, and I couldn't wait to get out and get a job. But the kind of jobs I was working in when I left were kind of fast food joints mostly. And I did that for a couple of years, just bumming around in low-end jobs. And then when I was 17, I hadn't planned on doing this either. I ended up joining the Air Force. And the reason I did that, I was just walking up the high street, going into shops, asking if they had any jobs going. And that day I got as far as the careers office. So I ended up joining the Air Force. That was as a mechanic, again, with no qualifications. And then after a few years of doing that, I met a girl, and she wanted me to have some kind of career when I left. So I started studying, started going to school then. And what I did was, I had a few years left, so I had a certain amount of time, but I couldn't study full time. So I looked through the adverts in the job sections of the newspapers, and everything was IT. So I thought, okay, well, this looks like the thing to get into. And another really good bonus of it was I didn't need to get a degree to break into the industry. You know, so this is back in the late 90s. If you had your MCSE, it was really easy to walk into a job because there was more jobs than the people available to fill them. Yeah, that's basically what I did. That's how I started it.
We might have been working on Microsoft stuff around the same time. I was working on a lot of Microsoft and Novell stuff in the late 90s and did a lot of rip and replace of Novell into Microsoft, various technologies, whether that was GroupWise for mail, bye-bye Novell, and then Hello Exchange and Outlook, woohoo! And the same thing for file and print services, a lot of NetWare servers going away and Microsoft coming in. And right, I was MCSE back in the day in the late 90s doing that kind of work.
Back when those four letters meant something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So when you did all that, Neil, and then did you kick around the industry? At some point you transitioned into instruction, it sounds like.
Yeah, well, that was, I'd been working quite a few jobs over several years. I already got married, settled down by this point, and we were living in Scotland, and it's cold over there. It's really cold. My wife and I, we don't like cold. We said, okay, let's move somewhere hot. But at the time, I'd also started getting really more into networking at that point. So I had my CCNP from Cisco, those kind of qualifications. That was enough to get a good job in Scotland. But if I was going to get a job somewhere in another country, you know, moving to another country, you need to really have a bit more than that. Because for them to employ you, they have to fly you over there. They have, you know, normally we're going to help you with your housing as well. It's a big deal for a company to take somebody from another country in. So you really need something more. So I did my CCIE then. And again, as you know, that opens up a load of doors for you. Once I'd got it, I just started sending my resume out to various countries over in Asia and in Australia. And it was through that I got the job that I'm doing now.
Jeepers, you went all the way up to CCIE. And for similar reasons, in my mind, I did some of the same certification progression, just looking for additional opportunities. Although I love cold. I mean, there is snow outside my house right now, and I couldn't be happier about that. The first significant snowfall was yesterday. I am pleased.
No, I'm with Neil. We agree. Ethan, you can go live in your snowy hut. I'll be down here where it's warm. So when you moved over there, was your primary job what you do now was to train people, or were you doing more specific hands-on, I'm building and fixing networks kind of thing?
Yeah, once I moved into the job, it changed. This was my first training job. So before that, I was always hands-on engineer. What I do now, it's predominantly training. We have a services division as well, so I help them out too, but that's mostly mentoring. Occasionally, if they need some help with a configuration, I'll help them out with that. But my day-to-day is either delivering training courses or actually writing them.
So, Neil, you've done a lot. You've got a lot of significant certs. You've moved around the world. You're training now. You've looked at your career as it's advanced. You made some big commitments. Those certifications are hard to get. What were your primary motivators? And it wasn't just to move somewhere warm. You could have done easier moves and accomplished that goal, perhaps. What were the things driving you the most to advance in your IT career?
Okay, back at the start, it was a girl. You know, it's always a girl, right? So, yeah, I was an Air Force mechanic. I was working on fighter jets. And actually, within the Air Force, you can be in lots of different jobs within the military. I found myself in this great job. It was the cushiest job in the whole military, probably, where what I was working on was visiting aircraft section. So I didn't really have to get my hands dirty. They would come in and I would just fill them up with petrol. And then, you know, you see the guys with the wands that wave them in and wave them out. That's what I was doing. Before that, I was, you know, an engine mechanic, and I was doing stuff like engine changes. And I'm not so good with my hands. And being out on a freezing pan in Scotland doing an engine change with snow falling around you, that's no fun at all. That section I was in, we were shift workers. The shift hours were great. We had a pool table in there. We had a dartboard. We had satellite TV. I was working with my best friends. It was a great job. I really wasn't looking at the future at that point. But then my girlfriend, you know, we were talking about going to settle down and get married. And she said, well, you better think about what you're going to do when you leave the Air Force. So that was what really pushed me in the first place. Once I got started, I liked it. And it turned out I was pretty good at it. And it was fun. So it was actually fun for me to learn the new stuff. And with that came the career advancement as well. So I'd be in a position, I think this is the same for most people, you know, if you start in the help desk, when you're working in the help desk, you're looking at the people in the network team or the server team, and they're getting more interesting jobs to do, and they're getting paid more. You know, if you're working in a large company, even within the IT department, was kind of a status there, you want to get up to that higher level. I would do that. And then once you're there, then you want to be the team leader. And then once you're the team leader, you want to be the IT manager. I think it's natural to do that.
Actually, let's drill into that. What was it about seeing those positions of additional responsibility that made sense to you that's what I want to do? I don't want to just be help desk. I want to be the team lead. I don't want to just be the team lead. I want to be the IT manager. I think some people, I've made this mistake myself. I was like, I always want to be at that next level of responsibility. And then I've been in manager roles a number of times over my career and found that wasn't where I was happiest. I could do it. I could be the manager and have people reporting to me and all of that stuff. But I didn't love that like I loved actually working on equipment and fixing things and listening to a problem the business had and designing an IT solution that was going to help deal with that issue. The manager role for me took away from a lot of those things that I loved the most.
Yeah, I'm with you now. My favorite thing to do is troubleshooting. I love troubleshooting. It's always the most interesting thing. You know, it's more interesting than learning the theory as well when you're actually putting it into practice. I love that. Oh, and another thing kind of along the same lines is if you're given charge of a project and seeing that through from start to completion, and then you're really happy with the way that it turned out, I get a lot of job satisfaction from that too. Actually, when I was talking about the progression, you know, from help desk up to IT manager, that wasn't actually how it worked out for me. It's how it works for most people, but I ended up being really lucky. Because when I left the Air Force, this is really late 90s, and you know the whole time the Millennium Bug thing was happening. So IT was huge at the time. And actually the day that I left, I put my resume out to some recruitment agencies. Well, mobile phones had been out not that long at this time as well. And it was crazy. I actually got stressed out because the whole day that my resume went out, both phones were ringing off the hook the whole time. I'd gone back up to my mother's house until I got a job. So I was going to just stay with her, you know, a month or so until I got a job and got my own place. And so the whole time I'm on my mobile phone, and then she's telling me, oh, there's somebody on the phone for you. So I'd take the house phone, and then my mobile phone was ringing. And it was just a great time to be looking for a job in IT then. So I was lucky enough that I really got to pick and choose which job I wanted. And the job that I got is working for this oil company in Aberdeen. At the time, there was just me and the manager, but I really liked the job because there was only about 200 people working there, but they were flush with money. It was a very profitable company, so they had all the latest technology, which made it fun to work there. What ended up happening was the manager left about 3 or 4 months after I started. Because I'd been doing a good job, and the company were happy with me, I got the IT manager's job. And then the next month after that, we got bought by this huge company who do like venture capitalism. And then they bought our biggest competitor as well. So I ended up being the IT manager of a team of people. So I'd gone from being, you know, just like entry-level engineer in the Air Force to, in 4 months later, I was IT manager looking after a team of people for this really profitable oil company. I worked hard to get in that position as well, but there was quite a lot of luck that it worked out that way. So once I was in that position, I kind of, you know, you don't want to drop down a level from there as well, is another thing.
Do you think that the gauntlet of going into help desk and then rising your way to the top through hard work and just time is still a necessary evil in today's world? Or can you just, I don't know, kind of go to school, get some certs and move directly into the role that you want? And I ask that because I remember when help desk was just a rite of passage that everyone had to do. Really, it was like you have to have some of the years of experience to get in there. Now it feels like maybe not so much, but I'm curious about your perspective.
I'd probably think if you're programming, it's probably going to be different. But if you're working as a network or a systems engineer, that's still probably going to be the path. I don't see how you could really leapfrog doing that. There's ways that you can accelerate it, but I think you would still end up probably going through the same kind of steps.
Well, Ethan, I think the easy takeaway from this one is it's always fun to work somewhere that has money. You get to do things and buy things and build things. It can be a challenge. It can be fun. I've worked in environments where it's like, hey, you get $2,000. That's your budget for the entire year. And you're like, that's impossible. It certainly makes you creative and finding free stuff and cobbling together. But at the same time, it can be a lot of fun when you have a healthy budget so that you can really build IT, I guess, appropriately, correctly. You know, you can actually spend and build things in a way that is advantageous to a proper enterprise design. What are you thinking, sir?
Oh, the big point that stuck out to me was liking what you do. I was in that treadmill of always wanting more responsibility and to be the person in charge and live to regret it in my IT career, where I ended up with, I got what I asked for and I was sorry. So, but a lot of that for me was driven by money. Well, if I want, you know, more money, if I want a better salary, then I've got to be the next thing up, whatever the next thing up was. And eventually the next thing up was an IT manager. You know, I'd go to my boss or whatever and go, how do I advance? How do I make more money? Well, the only thing we can do is put you in a manager role. And they'd look at me like, are you sure you want to do that? And I'd be like, yeah, I do, because it needs more money. And then I'd be in that role thinking it was all going to be fine. And I just didn't dig it. So people that love troubleshooting, like Neil mentioned, and they love, you know, working with tech, think twice before you go into a manager role if your only motivation is money. Liking what you do is way more important to your mental health. As we pause the Datanauts infrastructure rocket for just a moment, let's talk about the conference the Packet Pushers are going to be at in May 2017, Interop ITX, and they are a sponsor of today's show. Interop ITX is where tech pros go to get objective, full-stack IT education, and it takes place May 15th through 19th at the MGM in Las Vegas. You can join me, Ethan Banks, along with Greg Farrow and Drew Conry Murray of the Packet Pushers, where we will be putting on the Future of Networking Summit, and that is a two-day session where we're going to take a deep dive into next-generation developments in the WAN, data center networking, network operations, software-defined security, all the things that we think are emerging over the next 1, 5, and 10 years. Register for Interop ITX and attend other hands-on workshops like the Future of Data, Container Crash Course, Dark Readings Cybersecurity Summit, and the Open Source IT Summit. The event's conference tracks focus on security, DevOps, cloud, infrastructure, data and analytics, all the technologies you need for a successful full-stack IT strategy. If you're looking to accelerate your career, there's also plenty of sessions on leadership and professional development. Plus, check out over 100 vendors at Interop ITX's Business Hall, where you'll have the opportunity to check out what leading and emerging tech vendors have to offer. Join us at Interop ITX this coming May and use promo code PacketPushers when you register, and you'll receive a 20% discount. We want to see you in Vegas, so go on up to interopitx.com and reserve your spot today.
So, Neil, a little while ago, I got a message from you about a NetApp lab that you put together, and it was kind of like how to put it together. It was a nice little write-up on basically learning. You know, it was how to formulate a lab, some of the tips and tricks that you're putting together. I like that because I feel like the idea of constantly learning is, it's not really a choice when it comes to technology, right? You can't just get a certification or learn some kind of piece of tech and then just sit down and say, I'm done, and plant a flag in that, right? What is it that you're looking to do to support the idea of constantly learning within the IT field?
Oh, with my blog right now, I was trying to do something that isn't already being done by other people. My background, to be honest, is more on the networking side than the storage side. So with my blog, I want to cover really a wide array of cloud and data center technologies. But right now I'm focusing on storage because there wasn't really much else out there about it already. And I had to learn storage myself a few years ago. And it was really hard. There wasn't really anything out there that I could find that were for people that were coming from a sysadmin or a network engineer's background. Everything seemed to be, you're brand new to computing, to IT, you don't know anything. Or at the other end, it was, you're already an experienced storage engineer. Here's how it works with this particular vendor's technology. A lot of the material I've got in my site, there's a lot of NetApp stuff because I'm a NetApp trainer, but I've also got, I put a free course on there, an introduction to SAN and NAS, which is really aimed at people that are already working in the data center but are new to storage.
Yeah, it's a nice way to kind of showcase your skills, get people interested in the idea of storage and perhaps go further along. But I also feel like there's this general sense of community around sharing that sort of content where we all jumped on the shoulders of someone else at some point, and we want to give that back just a smidgen, right? Just a little bit of that give back.
Well, for sure. That's why, you know, before we were talking about what would be a good topic for the show today, we could have done something technical maybe, but what I'm really passionate about is helping people. And I thought that a way that I could maybe give some value to your audience is if we talk about career advancement, because really everybody is interested in that. And I'm quite experienced now, you know, I've been in industry for quite a while. And I thought maybe, you know, for people that are coming in or not sure what to do, maybe we could cover some things that I could really help them.
And I found that as you share knowledge and try to teach others, my personal experience is that reinforces the knowledge that you're teaching at such a high level that it helps you retain it. You know, the courses that I've managed to teach and whatnot, that kind of knowledge just really sticks with me versus reading it or just going through a lab a few times. So even though you are contributing, I think, to the greater community, there's still a huge self-benefit in that you're going to really master that technology. And through the process of teaching and people asking you questions, you'll find those gaps in the knowledge and go, okay, I didn't know that thing. I need to go relearn this. And there's some imposter syndrome where like, I need to make sure I know everything about the topic so they don't bust my chops. That was my personal experience with it. What about you, Neil?
For sure. You really do, because it depends on the particular class you get. But sometimes you'll go in a class and there's really advanced students in there and they already know the basics of what you're teaching and they're there because they want to know the advanced stuff. So if you don't know it, then things are not going to turn out well for you. So yes, actually, I remember the very first class that I taught was the Cisco IP telephony class. And this was only a few months after I'd passed my CCIE. But when I went through the course material, there was stuff in there that I didn't actually know yet. So I was still learning stuff. And again, like you said, you know, sometimes if you're studying because you want to pass an exam, then maybe you'll go so deep on some particular topic in there. But if you have to teach it, then you really have to go deeper because you don't want to look like an idiot if somebody asks you a question in class. You don't always have to give them an immediate answer, but you have to, if it was something that you would be reasonably expected to know, then you really do need to.
Neil, you're teaching NetApp classes and you've mentioned you had a background that was somewhat different, networking and so on, not storage focused. Now, are you seeing people in your classes that are also crossing over? And if so, is it just because they got a new job and so they've got new responsibilities? Or I'm asking this in the context of we're getting emails from people who are telling us their jobs are changing somewhat where they used to have this one silo, one bit of technology they worked on, and all of a sudden they're being asked to do more, cover more silos, handle more of the data center.
Yes, very much so. I'm sure you've seen that personally as well. It used to be the same for me when I was working in a networking job. That's all I needed to know. I needed to know routing and switching and security and the routing and the networking stuff. But now with the cloud and virtualization, there's not those clear lines between the job roles anymore. There's lots of gray areas. Like with VMware, there's the virtual switch in there now. So the networking team has to talk to the virtualization team. And then with VMware, you're going to need to have centralized storage for that. So now the virtualization guys need to talk to the storage team. Now we've got FCOE, so the storage team needs to talk to the networking team. And everything, all the new technologies are really merging together. And so there's not those clear lines between the job roles anymore. And with the students that come into the classes, yes, I'm seeing that all the time. Almost no students will have just one area of expertise now. When they come into a storage class, I'd be really surprised if they don't have a good understanding of virtualization. Maybe not so much networking, but normally they'll have at least a little understanding of that as well.
You and I are both CCIEs, and we know what the pain was of getting to that certification and earning that and all the study and lab time, et cetera. Considering what you just said, the fact that people are being asked to do all different sorts of silos now, does it make sense to pursue those super advanced degrees? Like Chris is a VCDX, you know, we're CCIEs and there's other super hard certifications to get. Does it even make sense to go after something like that? Or does it make sense to focus on a variety of things, be more broad, be multidisciplinary?
It definitely still makes sense to get the higher level certification. Passing the CCIE changed my life. If I hadn't done that, I would still be staying in Scotland right now. I'd be a network engineer for an oil company in Aberdeen. Because I passed the CCIE, I was able to, I live in Thailand now. I travel half the year. I love the company I work for. The owner is my best friend. I love my job. I love my life now. That would never have happened if I hadn't passed the CCIE. So the path to get there is maybe going to be a little bit different now, though, because before, if you were doing networking, it would be normal to go CCNA and then CCNP and then CCIE. What would probably be a better idea now would be maybe go CCNA and then CCNP and then also learn about VMware or whatever virtualization technology your company is using. Also learn a little bit of storage as well. So I would probably try to get a broader understanding of all the different technologies, but then specialize in one.
Yeah, my personal take was going kind of broad. Like if I first went for the CCNA, CCNP, VCP, all the pick vendor name and add professional or associate to the end of their certification as needed. And then after having that nice baseline where I was advised to get five tools, you know, storage, network, security, application, virtualization, you know, whatever the five things are to make yourself semi-broad, and then went really heavy into VMware and went after the BCDX. Because I just feel like it would be challenging today unless there was a super huge company that needed like just the network ninja and that's all you're ever going to do. The idea of being in that silo and never leaving it feels very foreign nowadays. Whereas before, you could be a storage engineer and just work on storage all day long, like a big buffet filled with just filet mignon. That's all it was. And you could love filet mignon, and that was the storage. Whereas now, it's like there's so many ways that line's crossing with automation and then the DevOps type culture shifts with virtualization. We blended a lot of these silos. It would be challenging, I think, to be 100% pure, you know, like Neil, what you're saying, to just totally focus on one thing and not have that broader baseline, at least at like an introductory or maybe intermediate level with other technologies.
Yeah, I agree.
Neil reinforced an impression that we've gotten on this show and given on this show, which is the silos are definitely coming down and you can't just live a happy life with the one thing you know and you're good at. Oh, you're the Sandmaster. We must go to the Sandmaster and approach the throne and kiss the ring, and they will provision sand for me. And that's all you do because you're the Sandmaster. No, it doesn't work like that anyway. Cloud and virtualization are blurring those clear silo lines, and everybody's got to know something about everything. We've made that point on this show many times before, and so I don't feel like I need to park there for too long, but it was nice to hear some outside confirmation that we are indeed seeing that across the industry. What stuck out to you, Chris?
Well, will you start calling me the Sandmaster going forward? I want that to be my new nickname. Is that okay?
Sure.
But seriously, I'll take what you said and I'll add a spin to it in that there can be an advantage to going super deep into a technology as a way to advance once you have that baseline established, which is why I talked about a little bit earlier. So I think that, yes, CCIE, BCDX, whatever that might be, I think that could be kind of your mountain to climb once you've gotten the rest of the things out of the way, either for personal gratification or because you're chasing something and that ultimate level certification will set you apart from other candidates or perhaps pole vault you into that new stratum of your IT career. Just don't focus on that as the one thing to have. It may be more of a capstone to have as you're going through the mid or later parts of your career.
DataNauts listeners, Ethan here. I'm sure you're aware that DDoS attacks are a normal part of life. You've probably been hit by one, or you're going to be at some point in the future, and our sponsor Encapsula can protect you from those DDoS attacks, distributed denial of service, while also offering bot protection, website security, load balancing, a content distribution network, and it is all one easy-to-use service. And if you're missing what the point of this is, the big idea is to put Encapsula in front of your website so that your website is protected. Your website will continue to deliver content even when bad things are happening. The thing here is that Encapsula is seeing all of your traffic anyway, so they're going to block that bad stuff, which is maybe the most important thing. But since they're seeing it all, they're going to accelerate that good stuff too. The bad stuff goes away, the good stuff gets even better. And if you think DDoS protection is no big deal, I personally think it's a really big deal. It's not hard these days for someone to build or even rent someone's command and control network and then unleash terror on your website, keeping your web down, offline. Encapsula protects you from this sort of an attack because they have their own massive network, 3 terabit per second network with 30 data centers housing their packet scrubbers. And I love this little detail. They codenamed their packet scrubbers Behemoth. Behemoth scrubbers can handle 500 million packets per second. And all of that put together means that putting Encapsula in front of your website means that you can withstand a DDoS attack. So to add Encapsula's capabilities to your website, visit encapsula.com/packetpushers and use promo code DATANAUTS to get a 30-day free trial. One more time, that's encapsula.com/packetpushers and use promo code DATANAUTS to get a 30-day free trial. Well, Neil, in the intro, I mentioned that we were going to talk about a survey that you took, CTOs, HR department heads, and some other folks, asking them about skills and so on. Why don't you describe for us what the survey was and just in general the sorts of things that you were asking?
Okay, when I got invited on the show, I was super excited about it and I wanted to do something extra to give the listeners some extra value. So I had to think about it. And the idea that I came up with was I reached out to the best known bloggers and authors in the industry. I also reached out to the CTOs of big companies and the CIOs at universities, and also out to the heads of HR in big companies, and also out to recruiters. And the question I asked them was, what's the best piece of advice you could give to someone looking to start an IT career in 2017?
Okay, so not a long survey, just one big open-ended question.
Yes.
Okay. And so out of that big question, that what were there themes that emerged? What sort of big takeaways did you find?
Yeah, there was very strong themes that emerged, more than I expected, really. I got over 100 people responding to the question. Out of all 100 of those, it boiled down just to 7 main responses. The one that came in first that was most popular was that you need to be ready for change. You need to constantly update your skills. The second one was to choose a job role that you're going to be passionate about. After that was to work on your social skills, not just your technical skills. The fourth one was to challenge yourself. Then it was to develop full stack skills, so not just within one traditional job role. After that was to take a business viewpoint. So don't look at things just from purely an IT point of view, but whenever you're making any decisions, it should be for the benefit of the business. And the last one was to take part in the IT community. So take part in user groups, maybe start your own blog, that kind of thing.
So that's interesting. This wasn't just hitting you on the head with specific technical skills, but also you're becoming a more well-rounded person. In your 7 main responses, I see a theme there that is, this is going to sound weird, you need to be a better human to function better because of the business impact that technology has.
Yeah, when I was looking at this, it kind of, do you get the IT crowd, you know, the TV show? Is that popular in the US as well? It's kind of old now, but it was big in the UK a few years ago.
For a while, it was going around the torrents. Yeah, we'd be sharing the IT crowd over here. I know a bunch of us watched it.
Okay. I mean, that, you see the guys in there, they're kind of, it's a cliche of what an IT department is and all the bad things about it. But things become a cliche for a reason. You know, a lot of the places I've worked, it's maybe not as amped up as that, but a lot of the IT staff really are like that. So yeah, a big point coming from the responses was to be aware of the bigger picture in your company, to look at it from the business point of view, and to work well as part of a team.
And that kind of feeds to me into the ideas that the DevOps movement are trying to focus on. I mean, there's the, let's support your developers and do all that kind of jazz. But to me, it's more like business development and IT and business operations, which are supported by IT and supported by the developers. The idea that you're not your own world, you know, you're a cog in a greater machine, And unless you're able to take that step back and understand the system as a whole, which I think we do as technologists anyways, Neil, you're talking about you love troubleshooting. In order to troubleshoot, you have to understand end-to-end what's going on and where is it breaking. And we just need to apply that as a collective to the entire business, understand all these different BUs, how they integrate together, and what the user is trying to get out of the experience in order to really make IT great again. I'm not going to make a hat for that. But realistically, there's actually, I'll bring up a tweet that I favorited recently, and it was from Gene Kim talking on the virtual brown bag, the V brown bag recently. And he was quoting a guy at New Context named Nathan, who said he was a lifelong ops practitioner. And he knows that we need these sorts of practices like DevOps to make work humane, because he cited that he's worked every holiday, birthday, his wife's birthday, and even on the day his son was born, because IT is just so broken. And it just causes us to fight fires and work weekends and nights and stuff to the point where this guy's missing a lot of really important life experiences. And that's where I feel what you've surveyed with the people that are basically expressing the same thing really resonates with me quite well because of experiences such as that.
Neil, you said full stack skills. Now, I know people gave you more verbose answers. Can you dive into what full stack skills meant, maybe more specifically based on the answers you got back?
One that's a good example of this, the response was, if you work in the networking team, then learn virtualization. If you work in the server team, then learn storage and so on. So it was about cross-scaling. Really what we were talking about earlier on in the podcast, that you can't just focus in one technology, one area now. You really need to spread your skills across the entire range.
Did any of the responses get more specific about things like automation or software-defined whatever kind of things? We cover a lot of this stuff on Datanauts, but yet it's emerging technology for a lot of companies, those specific skills. So I'm just curious if any of the folks that responded had those, you know, more specific things that they were looking for.
Yes. Yeah, I needed to talk about that as well, because the list of seven I gave you before, that was general tips. Another thing was that two particular skills really were highlighted in the responses as well. The first was to learn coding and working with APIs now. And the second was security.
So let's start on APIs. First of all, who was suggesting that? Were these the C-levels? Were these the HR people? Who was suggesting that those were skills that were required?
These were mostly the authors and the bloggers. In fact, out of HR and recruiters, nobody mentioned that. But the people that are actually working hands-on, coding and APIs, there was a huge amount of responses that said that.
And then from your, as you deal with the classroom and people that are in the class, does that jive with some of the stuff you're teaching and what they're looking for?
No. Kind of surprisingly,
really?
Not. Yeah, really, not at all. This is something I need to skill up in. You know, we've been talking about the need to keep your skills going as well. You know, this, even guys like us that have been working in the industry for a long time, there's still that constant change. And I mean, I just felt like I finally cracked it when I knew virtualization and networking and storage. And I've hardly had time to blink, and now I need to learn coding and automation as well. I haven't actually needed to yet, because in the classroom, it really never comes up. Actually, I'll talk about this kind of thing in general, because I do a lot of data center and cloud courses. So I'll be talking, you know, I'll bring up the front end of AWS, you know, Amazon Web Services, and I'll spin up an instance in there. I'll be using that as an example of what automation is. And I'll tell the class, you know, this is what's coming. Maybe you're not going to be designing the front end, but the systems in between that and your actual infrastructure, you're going to be working on that. And you're going to have to learn the languages to be able to do this. Yet it's all been coming from me going to them so far. I haven't had much demand for it yet. But really, I'm sure that it is coming.
I think it's also, in order to automate and work with these scripting languages or programming languages, you have to first understand the infrastructure at a pretty deep level in multiple different ranges. You know, you have to make this thing, this storage array, talk to this particular network device, or you're trying to get two things to talk together or at least configure themselves for the greater whole. So perhaps, you know, they're looking to understand, you know, NetApp storage or something like that at a deeper level. And then there's also the fact that a lot of the legacy, traditional infrastructure, whatever you want to call it, just did not support APIs or programmatic control of those systems. They were designed where they'd had a CLI somewhere that you have to SSH into or whatnot, or perhaps some type of crappy automation language that was remote available. But for the most part, I think they were designed to be manually configured. It's only recently that we're seeing anything in the cloud is going to be API driven, but most things within the data center just simply aren't yet. That's a moving target.
You know what, Chris, though? I think there's something else here, and as I'm reflecting on how a lot of people gain their knowledge or exposed to new ideas, and that is through blogging and writing, you know, people like us, I guess, that are showing you how a lot of this kind of thing is done. Some of it comes in training programs. You know, we learned what we learned because we sat in a VMware class or a Cisco class and learned the vendor way to do things. And I don't know how much using a programmatic interface versus a traditional interface is really being taught out there. And I don't think we're seeing – I mean, I follow a lot of blogs, just people down in the trenches sitting in the hot aisle doing what they do, their day-to-day work. It's still a lot of CLI examples. It's still a lot of GUI examples of how to get something done, as opposed to I wrote this script that does that. And so maybe it's, you know, there's just a dearth of knowledge out there, training about how to get things done in a programmatic way, how to leverage the new interfaces. My point being, maybe we all got to just dig in a little deeper, some of us, and start showing off the techniques we've learned and the things we've figured out about how to do things programmatically versus falling back to the way that we're all also comfortable with. Neil, I'll kick a question back to you. In your NetApp classes, does any official NetApp training or the way you guys teach NetApp get into APIs?
Not at all. It will maybe be briefly mentioned, like on maybe one slide, it will mention that an API is available, but no, because the thing is, there's not really demand for it. I mean, we could write a class on that, but there wouldn't be anybody really wanting to send their staff on it.
Yeah, because I think it's a process and a workflow thing too, where a lot of shops have not moved into an automated workflow to provision infrastructure. It's still a manual process and ticket-driven and, you know, throw this over the wall, et cetera. And it's been more the companies that are DevOps-driven, where they need a tight integration between application release cycles and infrastructure provisioning that have been – they just need this from a business perspective to be able to very quickly bring their apps up. I don't think a lot of businesses are necessarily – needing to be that agile, to use the buzzword.
I don't know. You don't know what you don't know, right? If you don't realize that, I hate that this kind of preacher mentality that, oh, you got to support your devs and help the programmers. And, you know, a lot of places I worked didn't have developers or programmers, so I didn't really care about that. But what we did have was the need to stand up infrastructure in some way, shape, or form. It could be for users or just standing up user accounts. It could be ACLs. It could be, I mean, there's all sorts of stuff. The data center is a very complex moving organism that's more than just rack and stacking new boxes and supporting people that are writing code. What people don't seem to realize is that through automation, through scripting languages, through APIs, whatnot, you can make processes very consistent and spread the knowledge outside of one person if you have a shop that has multiple IT people and make it so that a process can be leveraged by any person with minimal skill set. You know, you can get a force multiplier out of your team so that you're not that single point of failure. You can go on vacation and whatnot. I think those are two major drivers to start supporting learning a coding language and talking to APIs. But if things are just working okay and you don't realize that you could be spending 80% of your time doing cool stuff instead of 80% of your time keeping the lights on, you just don't go down that path.
Oh, tough dilemma, because I'm going back to Neil. Your comment was, geez, I got all this stuff. I got to this knowledge point where I was pretty happy, and wait, now I got to learn automation. And I think there's maybe some of that too, where some people are just like, I just spent the last 5 or maybe 10 years of my career in this never-ending cycle of more and more and deeper learning about whatever it is my specialty is, and now I got to keep learning. I'm tired. I don't want to keep doing this stuff. Well, Neil, let's change topics here. We coding and APIs, okay, we talked about that. You heard about that from the blogging community, and we went around about that. What about security? You mentioned security was one of the themes that came through as a need.
Yeah, this was mostly from the CTOs and the recruiters. I was skeptical, to be honest, when I first saw this, because we remember security has always been a hot topic ever since I can remember. Like back when I first started, viruses were a big deal. And then we had worms like Slammer and Blaster. And then we've had things like the problems, you know, with credit card details being stolen and stuff like this. And now that cloud is getting very popular, so you're out more in public infrastructure, it's a big deal. Really, all throughout my career, when I've looked at the actual job market, it hasn't been reflected so much. There's been nowhere near as many jobs in security as there has been in networking or in Microsoft, for example. And at the training company I'm at now, we haven't really seen an increase in demand for security courses either. So I was skeptical about that. But what I did was I wanted to verify it. So I did some research on the job sites, and it turns out that security is actually huge right now. There's loads of companies that really are looking for security professionals. So it is a good area to be in right now.
Can you qualify what you think it means to be a security professional just based on some of the job descriptions you saw and so on?
Yeah, because you're right. I mean, we're all security professionals anyway. If you're working in networking, then security is a huge part. But really, if you're working in anything, if you're in the server team, the storage team, the networking team, security is just part of your job. So I'm not talking about, oh, you should, you know, learn security because it's big in the job market right now. You need to know security anyway. But if you're actually specializing in security, then it's a good time in the market for you right now. And the kind of jobs out there are, again, if we look at it from a certification point of view, I think, you know, like certified ethical hacker, penetration testers, that kind of job role. Also, you know, just being in a security team. So maybe if you're from a networking point of view, if you're going to be working on intrusion prevention systems, that kind of thing, it's very hot right now.
Yeah, I've done a bunch of security-related certifications over the years in security. Infrastructure security with dealing with firewalls, intrusion prevention systems, et cetera, has been off and on a part of my job role. I think one of the most valuable things I got out of security training was learning in a course-driven way how hackers, if you want to use that term, do what they do. In other words, what the attack surface is of your systems, and so that you can begin to think in a way that, okay, if I was going to attack my infrastructure, where are the weak parts? How would I go about that? In those classes, in security-specific classes, you get a sense of just how these attacks happen. You know, it's nice that you can take the firewall and build a security policy that limits the ports that are exposed to the public internet. But if you still have to have a web port open, you haven't filtered off a SQL injection attack. And so if you want to specifically handle a SQL injection attack, you may need to take other steps, and then the defense in depth posture and all of that. A lot of people just look at security as an inconvenience. I don't want to deal with security because it's going to make my time to production for that app slower, or the security guy is the one that's always saying no to me and I don't like that. And really, the endless hacks that we're seeing, many of which are newsworthy, I think show not a weakness in security technology, although maybe that's part of it, but a weakness in security methodology, how we're not putting secure systems in place.
Security technology is rarely the issue outside of like the whole IoT DDoS stuff. I mean, that's just crappy vendors writing crappy security. But to me, it still comes down to making sure that the user is making decisions that does not compromise the system. You know, you can set up two-tier user accounts, one that's admin, one that's normal user, et cetera. But people are always the vulnerability within any kind of enterprise, and you can't eliminate people. At least, I don't know, that sounds really harsh. Like, we're trying to automate a lot of them out of there, but realistically, there's always going to be people somewhere in the equation, and so there always will be vulnerabilities. It's really about just making sure that you understand security at a level where you can eliminate all the really low-hanging fruit security vulnerabilities and not have yourself exposed in a very known, vulnerable, and I guess public way. At least that's my take on security. I think a lot of it, though, It's just a huge investment into fattening a vendor's wallet.
Oh boy, that's a cynical way to look at it. I think that is part of it, man. But I've begun to, my interest in security has been rekindled. We published a show on unikernels where a lot of the drive for publishing an app in a as a unikernel is about reducing attack surface, where you taking away all of the bits of code that are unnecessary for the application to actually run, because it takes away those hidden bits of code that you're not leveraging but are sitting there in the background that could perhaps be taken advantage of. And so I think there's, yes, lax user behavior and, you know, bad practices is the biggest part, that low-hanging fruit, Chris. But I think there's also just kind of inherent in the way we've built our application stacks over the years and the way we're used to standing up apps has led us down a road of vulnerabilities. And so I'm not, Neil, I'm not surprised that you saw a lot of security demand and then, you know, followed that up looking around at available jobs, you know, that security is a thing. What else did you see? I mean, IoT has been a big buzzword. Did you see a lot of demand for IoT-related jobs?
Hardly a heartbeat for IoT. Very little interest. That's another thing I was skeptical about as well, was IoT. But again, that's a huge buzzword in the industry right now. Now, actually, I'd be interested to get your guys' opinion on this, because maybe I'm missing something. Maybe I'm way off base with this, but I don't see IoT really being that big in the future. It seems to me that there's useful stuff, you know, like in the US, you can program your fridge to talk to Amazon and it'll order your groceries whenever it's running out. And that's great. But if I'm an organization, I don't need to hire an engineer to program my fridge for me. So again, I'm thinking about, maybe I'm missing something with IoT. So Cisco came out with a course on it. In fact, about a year ago, our general manager said, hey, Neil, you need to get into IoT. I need you to learn this stuff. It's going to be huge. And I said, really? Are you sure? And I had a look at the courseware, and it's mostly about telemetry stuff. And because I'm from Aberdeen, we'll work in oil and gas there. I actually worked for an oil field engineering company before that specialized in offshore telemetry. And I know that that is a very, very niche industry. So if you're looking at your normal organization, I don't see where they're going to have a need for IoT.
You just nailed my take on it, which is it's going to be industry specific. And there's a few industries where IoT will be huge, and localized data processing so that you get the real-time benefit of all that data and that telemetry will be a very big deal. Oil and gas is one. Energy generally is one of those industries. But IoT, for the vast majority of businesses, will have some impact, just because, yeah, there's things you can plug in and they give you some data, but it's not going to be this crushing, overwhelming burden of data that we've got to process now, and what are we going to do with it, and how are we going to handle that, that gets a lot of the IoT press. To me, it's going to be specific niches, specific verticals that are driving that, but not, again, not the industry widely. Chris, I don't know if you've got a take on that.
Well, you pinned it pretty earlier, me being cynical around a lot of that kind of jazz, especially around security. I think it's early days as well. You know, like we talked just a little bit ago about IoT, not a lot of buzz around that. Well, the fact that we're turning toasters and microwaves and such into attack surfaces to, you know, shut down various websites, it just feels like it's still early days. We're kind of being caught with our pants down a little bit. So the educational trends are always laggard behind where the technology is, and that's because the enterprise is typically laggard behind where the state of the art is. Nobody's really operating at the tip of the spear. Two reasons. One, it's risky. Two, most operations aren't set up to do such a thing. They're still in that old kind of methodology where it takes 18 months to really move the ship. So I don't think it'll forever be as horrible in the cynical picture that I paint it to be, but it's going to be a while to really fix a lot of these issues and spin up technologists who are ready to tackle the things that we're dealing with on a day-to-day basis.
Neil, as we're bringing the show to a close, are there any other big highlights from your survey that you wanted to bring out?
Oh, something I would just say is, I mean, I've covered the main points there, but obviously there's a lot of responses. So they go in a lot more detail, of course, than I have there. And also some of them are really left field and cover stuff that I haven't mentioned at all, but it's still really valuable. So I found it a pretty entertaining read, actually, myself, just going through them. Some of them made me laugh as well, and some of them really entertained me.
Well, Neil, thanks for coming on the show today, for being our guest on Datanauts. How can people follow you?
They can find me on my blog, which is at flatbox.com. And I've got all my social media buttons are on the right-hand side there. So that's the one place they can easily find me.
Awesome. Thanks very much. We talked about results from the survey today. Now, do you have a blog post or something where someone can go and kind of get a summary of what we've talked about?
Yes. By the time that this podcast comes out, I'm going to have it posted on my blog. I'll have all the responses there. And the same summary I went through here, I'll have down at the bottom there with all the main points.
Excellent. Thanks very much, Neil, for taking the time to share the results with us, chat about career. This was fun. And I'm glad our time zones aligned. It was a little tricky to get Thailand aligned, but we managed to work it out. And that is it for today's edition of the Datanauts podcast. I'm Ethan Banks. You can hear me screaming into my pillow about enterprise IT at EC Banks on Twitter. I do most of my blogging these days at packetpushers.net. And for the marvelous mental machinations of Chris, stalk him at Chris Wall on Twitter, and his blog is wallnetwork.com. For more technical podcasts about IT, head over to packetpushers.net. You'll find the entire Datanauts archive along with other Packet Pushers podcasts. And until then, may your server lights blink, your HVAC remain pressurized, and your cables be cleanly managed. And now one of you is supposed to say something.